Yeah, some business before we start. There are three people who owe me referee reports. Just close my eyes and turn off the lights and hope they appear right here. Come see me after, I guess. Okay. Yeah. So let me start off just by telling you a little bit about quantum random walks. The talk is about how to solve some problems in quantum random walk theory using generating functions. I've been doing generating function analysis for some years now, but let's start with a problem. So first of all, I suppose we have a classical simple random walk. What is a classical simple random walk on the integers? You know what it is, but let me say it differently. So let's say I have the set of probability measures on Z, and I have the evolution operator for a simple random walk. So let's say S equals 1/2 sigma plus 1/2 sigma minus. Okay, sigma plus is the shift. Everything goes 1 to the right. Sigma minus is the shift 1 to the left. So this operator here, if I start, for example, if I operate on the point mass at 0, then I get half point mass at minus 1 plus half point mass at plus 1. And as I operate s to the n times some starting position, then, you know, to understand simple random walk, I just see what the n-fold power is of this operator. And, of course, we have some weak convergence, rescaled to Gaussian. Okay, so that's how I think of simple random walk. Now, let's say I want to do this in the quantum world. So my state space looks the same, the integers. And instead of probability measures on Z, I have L2 of Z, little L2 actually, but anyway, L2 of Z. So complex valued functions. So if psi is a complex valued function, we have summation n equals minus infinity to infinity absolute psi of n squared should equal 1, i.e. the L2 norm of psi equals 1. So instead of probability measures, I have unit elements of L2. Okay, those are my possible distributions. And the probability that my particle is at position n is defined to equal the square amplitude there, psi of n absolute value squared. Okay, so you know, it's just some formalism. That's how what the quantum world is, sort of by definition. How about evolution operators in the quantum world? Well, sigma plus still exists. So sigma plus is a unitary operator. And that's good. Unitary operators are good for evolution because if I stick in a unit vector, I get out a unit vector. So it's still, since I have a unit vector, I can interpret the sum of the square amplitudes, or the square amplitudes as probabilities, and I'm fine. So sigma plus exists. Sigma minus exists. If I try and take this operator, 1/2 sigma plus 1/2 sigma minus, oops, it's not unitary. So, for example, if I apply that operator to delta 0, which is a nice unit vector, I get a wave function of 1/2 at minus 1, 1/2 at plus 1. The total, so square them, 1/4 and 1/4, add them, I get 1/2, it's too little. Out of luck. You know, in that particular case, you might think, okay, maybe 1 over root 2 sigma plus 1 over root 2 sigma minus, that certainly takes the delta function to a unit vector, but unfortunately that's not unitary either. For example, suppose I had something which had, if I try to apply this to summation n equals minus k to k, let's see, 1 over square root of 2k plus 1 delta, 2n plus 1, 2k plus 1 delta n. Right, so uniformly, probabilistically spread out over an interval from minus k to k, I hit it with this, and I get something too big. It's not unitary. In fact, so essentially up to, you know, a little variation, the only translation invariant unitary operators are these deterministic shifts. So we can't really construct a quantum random walk in the most naive way. So there is a construction of something that goes by the name of quantum random walk, I think reasonably so. And it goes like this. So we are going to enlarge the state space. So let's take z cross 2, maybe my two-element set, just for specificity, I'll take to be the symbol for up and down. So this corresponds to a particle that has not only a location, but a location and a spin. And these are simultaneously observable, so we have state space. It looks like this. Okay. And now let me introduce the quantum coin flip. Quantum coin flip is going to take whatever state I'm at, preserve the location, but randomize the spin somehow. So the spin coin flip is going to be, well, I won't write out the whole matrix for it because it has twice infinity rows and columns, but it's really a tensor product of the thing that's the identity in the location direction with a little 2x2 matrix. And there's actually, you know, many choices, but the easiest one, I think, to work with is this matrix. So if I apply this, for example, to a delta function in the up state, then I get 1 over root 2 amplitude in the up state and 1 over root 2 in the down state. Which is a nice fair coin flip. Same thing if I apply it to a delta function in the down state. I get this thing where you have a phase shift of 180 degrees in the second coordinate, but that's fine. Amplitude, don't care about that. So that's the quantum coin flip. And now, yeah, to do the quantum random walk, I'm going to take a second operator, and the second operator is the following unitary operator. I'll draw it in pictures. It takes anything in a state that's spin up and moves it one unit to the right, and it takes anything which is spin down and moves it one unit to the left. So in my big matrix, you know, matrix representation, it's a permutation matrix, just has a bunch of ones in corresponding to the pair of locations this and this, and the pair of locations this and this, etc. This is obviously a unitary operator. Yeah?
In each location, you have a mixture of up and down, right?
So I have 2 times z many dots here. The dots are my, so that's a location, comma, spin, okay? So let me write this down a little better. So I'm working in L2 of this space, right? So L2 of z cross up down. and I have an operator, let's say, just call it U, and U on delta sub n comma up equals delta n plus 1 comma up, and U on delta n comma down equals delta n minus 1 comma down. Yeah, right. Okay, so with this unitary operator, now let's suppose I start in some state, for example, delta 0 comma up, and then I apply the spin coin flip and then U. Okay, so if I do that, okay, so do the spin coin flip. So let's see what happens when I take this and I apply it to something that looks like delta 0 comma up. I remember why I didn't call this U in my notes. It's two U's, big U and little U. Let's call it something else. A. Okay, so the first thing takes it to a 1 over root 2 mixture like that, and the second thing pulls it apart, so I get a little picture, which is 1 over root 2 amplitude here, 1 over root 2 amplitude here, 0, 1, 2, 3, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and 0 everywhere else. Okay, so now, if I measure, so I have to say I don't really understand this idea of measuring, but if I measure, let's say, the location, it doesn't really matter which I measure, the location of the coin flip, because I'm going to know both. Yeah? Yes, it's the same, so it's the tensor product of the identity in the z direction with this 2x2 matrix. So as a block, it appears as a block of 2x2 matrices, one for every pair of positions. Right. So if I measure, I get to find out where I am, and I get to reset into a delta function at one of these places. And then if I do this operator again, it splits me equally likely into two places. And so if I keep measuring, then I'm just doing classical simple random walk. That's no fun. But the interesting thing happens when I don't keep measuring. So I just take the operator A times the spin flip, and I take it to the nth power. And that is what's known as a quantum simple random walk. So let's look and see what this quantum simple random walk actually does. So I'm just going to do a few steps for you. So we start off, let's say, in this position, and then we saw that we're in, even though it breaks the symmetry, it's easier to write and a little bit later easier to analyze if we we get rid of the periodicity. So we make it either move to the right or stand still. That way I don't have to put all those extra zeros in. Okay, so next time it becomes 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2, like that. And then, okay, let's see. We do the, so that's a full step. Let me do it by half steps, though. So this 1 over root 2 becomes 1/2, 1/2. This 1 over root 2 becomes 1/2 minus 1/2, and then we shift. So we get 1/2, 1/2, one half minus 1/2, like that. Okay? And so this is probability a quarter of being in each of these four states. And if we decide to measure simply the location, it looks like two fair coin flips. A quarter, half, a quarter. Nothing funny happened. Let's do one more time. So this one half becomes 1 over 2 root 2, 1 over 2 root 2. This one half, same thing. This one half becomes 1 over 2 root 2, negative 1 over 2 root 2. And then this minus a half becomes minus 1 over 2 root 2, 1 over 2 root 2. And of course, this is 0, and this is 1 over root 2. And now when we do our shift operator, we get 1 over 2 root 2, 1 over root 2, negative 1 over 2 root 2, and then down here, 1 over 2 root 2, 0, 1 over 2 root 2. So now in position 0, 1, 2, 3, the squared amplitudes are zero, an eighth, a half, an eighth, zero, an eighth, zero. And if I simply measure position, I get 1/8, 1/8, 5/8, 1/8. So it's different at the third stage and every stage thereafter from the classical simple random walk. So now it makes sense to ask what happens. So what kind of limit laws might there be for this object? And there are a number of papers. You can find them easily on the archive for quantum physics. And they give various levels of detail analyses of this random walk. Maybe I won't tell you just yet what the answer is. By the way, this is a little bit far afield from classical probability theory, but the probability theory that I started out doing when I was a graduate student was called random walk with reinforcement. So this lends new meanings to that term, if we have this quantum sort of reinforcement, interference, random walk with interference. Anyway, let's see how we might answer this, because it's really fairly elementary to analyze this particular quantum random walk. And I should say, so this is the first problem in a series of many problems, and I want to get to a higher dimensional quantum random walk, but let me just mention at this stage, this is not the only unitary coin flip, and if you put in a different coin flip, you get different answers, qualitatively the same, but quantitatively different. So there's some choices there. And these quantum coin flips, they bother me a little bit, because if you, for example, do two of these quantum coin flips in a row without measuring in between, you get the identity. So in this particular case, and in general, you know, if you sort of do n of these coin flips in a row, you get something, some kind of different mixture, and you're not really producing any entropy. So somehow it's interesting in this quantum random walk situation, because the locations are sort of drifting around, so you're recombining things in strange looking ways, and you get interesting effects. But you have to be a little bit careful of what, you know, whether you're happy with the interpretation. Anyway, that's the only. I don't know. Probably that's true and is known, but I don't know. So I'm a relative newcomer to this particular problem. Yeah. To say some experiment, I mean, okay, I'm not sure what that means, because we have this, we can, right, but So if we had a particular, like, isolated particle that just had a spin and a location, and then we wanted to make it do a quantum random walk, I think, I don't know, probably we could make it do this quantum random walk. But, so there's a nice survey paper by Kemp on quantum random walk and its application to quantum computing, where the first section surveys known results about the quantum random walk, and then they start saying, okay, well, if you want to actually build a quantum computer, right, quantum computers, if they could be built, can solve exponential problems in polynomial time, and, you know, that's scary, actually. anyway, and so I think there's some possibility that these devices could potentially be built and so forth, but I have to say I don't really know. Okay, rest assured, it can be done, so good. All right, so let's compute what happens here. Back here. So let's call this operator again. S, and then so we want to compute the let's say we decided to start in this state, zero spin up, and we apply the operator S n times, and then we want to see what the value is there at some state k comma, I don't know, up or down, I'll just say up. I could equally well do down. Let's see how we might compute that. So if you keep track of all these mixing and shifting operators, you see that the sum, this is equal to a sum over paths. So what can path do? It starts here at 0, comma, up, and then it can either stay here or go down with amplitude 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2. And then, of course, if it goes down, it has to shift. If it stays up, it has to shift. And if it goes down, it doesn't shift. But if we just take the spins, right, so we have a loop here, 1 over root 2, transition here, 1 over root 2, a loop here of minus 1 over root 2, and an amplitude for transitioning up of 1 over root 2. If we just do these, some sequence of these things, and then we count every time we make a transition from here to itself, and there's four possible transitions. Every time we make a transition from here to itself, we have to go to the right one. Oh, geez, I want to make a generating function. I want to keep track of how far we are to the right. So I'll call that x to the plus 1. Every time we make a transition down here, so this is, see, 1 over root 2 x to the plus 1. Every time we make a transition from up to down, we get 1 over root 2, but no x. If we go from down to up, we get 1 over root 2 and the shift. And if we go from down to down, we get minus 1 over root 2 and no shift. Okay, if we take the nth power of that matrix, then this counts, it's got four entries, and the top entry is going to count paths from up to up, and the other entries count the other three possible combinations. So we take the nth power of that, and then we take the 1-1 entry of that, because we're going from up to up, and then we take the x to the k coefficient, and that computes this. Okay, so let's see. Let's call this matrix M. not the nth power of it, just the matrix itself is m. So I can make a two-variable generating function that encodes all of this for all n. So I take summation y times m to the n, n equals 0 to infinity, and then the x to the k, y to the n coefficient is, again, the quantity I'm interested in. And, of course, this sum is equal to identity minus y times m inverse. Right. So I take identity minus ym inverse. It has four rational functions as entries. And the 1-1 rational function counts this. I could look at the 1-2 rational function entry, and it would count that. Let me just write down what this rational function is. So I minus ym inverse of 1 comma 1 equals, there's a numerator, which we don't care about. I'll call it p of x, y. It's a polynomial. And the denominator is 1 minus x minus 1 over square root of 2 times y minus xy squared. Okay, simple looking rational function. And so, so probability that quantum x sub n equals k equals x, the x to the k, y to the n coefficient of f. I'll call this f of x, y. So if we understand how to do asymptotics of coefficients of rational generating functions, which in this case we do, then out pops actually estimates of this, let's call this a of nk. We get estimates up to a factor of 1 plus little o of 1 of a of nk. They're actually uniform in certain regions. So that's great. I'll be talking about that shortly. But So let me first write down this function somewhere I won't lose track of it. And then let me talk about something which you won't find in the literature, which is behavior of two-dimensional quantum random walk. Okay, but the definition won't be too difficult now. So for two-dimensional quantum random walk, we want our location space to be Z2, and we want to do a fair four-way coin flip, and then, based on the state of the coin, move deterministically in one of the four directions, and do that over and over again. Okay, so four-way spin flip. We have to pick some matrix. So we just take a 4x4 matrix that's unitary and that takes any delta function to an even mix. And the easiest to work with, most symmetric, doesn't have any complex numbers in it, is this one. You can verify that this matrix is a nice four-way fair coin flip, and then you can play the same game. And in fact, since I went through it step by step for the one-dimensional quantum random walk, I won't feel compelled to do it step by step for the two-dimensional quantum random walk, but you get the same thing, right? You get powers of this matrix, except the possibility you want to keep track of both the x location and the y location, so one of these steps corresponds to moving, one of the columns corresponds to moving multiplying by x, 1 by y, 1 by x inverse, 1 by y inverse. Here I am letting it go four directions instead of breaking the periodicity and holding the coordinate still, just because this is the form you'll find it in. So multiply the columns like that, and then we take, so that's our new M, and we take identity minus Z times M inverse, and that gives me 16 generating functions depending on what state I start and stop in, and they all have the same denominator, which is the determinant, and that's why, and actually in generating function analysis, all you really care about is the denominator, so that's why I wrote it like this. So this is for the one-dimensional quantum coin flip. For the two-dimensional quantum coin flip, we get a fraction with some polynomial upstairs, and downstairs we get 1 minus z squared times 1 minus, I'll write it like this, twice x plus x inverse plus y inverse over 4 times z plus z squared. Okay, so a rational function, we don't care what's upstairs. Downstairs, we have two factors. One of them, 1 minus z squared, is just the product of two linear functions, 1 plus z and 1 minus z. The other function has this slightly more complicated form, but it's not too bad, and it tells us the shape of the limit theorem, as you'll see. Okay, so we'll keep those two functions up there, and then what I want to do is shift gears and describe how, yeah?
Your coin flip matrix.
Yes. So in both cases, if your coin flip matrix is different, you get something different, but you get something which is qualitatively the same, and you see it at the polynomial levels. And you give me another 2 minutes after I describe a little bit of how you can read off asymptotics by inspection here, then I can tell you in what ways really, nothing has fundamentally changed. Okay, so multivariate generating function theory in a nutshell. Begin with a, so let me say 1 minute about univariate generating function theory, literally just a minute. So if I have f of z summation an z to the n, and f is some nice function, and I want to read off asymptotics of the ans, knowing my nice function f, so what I do is I think of this, so it's a I think of it as a complex valued function. I look for the minimum modulus singularity. It probably occurs on the real line. It doesn't matter if it doesn't. But so let's say it occurs at R, and then I look at the, you know, what type of a singularity is. What is f like, just asymptotically near R? And so, for example, if f of z equals is asymptotic to z minus r to the minus alpha log 1 over z minus r to the beta. This is just an example of the kinds of theorems that exist. Then this immediately implies that an is asymptotic to a certain constant depending on alpha times n to the alpha minus 1 times log n to the beta, and so forth. The transfer theorems, Flagellin and Lithgow have a very nice survey paper in 1990 on these. You input the asymptotics of f near the singularity, outcome the asymptotics of the coefficient. Very nice. Yes, complicated other hypothesis. But it suffices really to have, let's say, f be analytic on some little epsilon neighborhood looking like this. So in the case where there's other singularities on the boundary, then you have to do some more work. But anyway, there's a huge literature on this and exactly what you get under what hypotheses, and it's pretty well understood. Any case that you're interested in, you know, Hardy and Ramanujan in the 1914 or something, did this very, very accurately for the asymptotic to the partition function, and been long known how to do this. Okay, so in the multivariate case, it's not so well understood, and it's been a good part of my research agenda since 1999 at least. So let me tell you, I don't really want to go through a whole summary of it, but let me just give you sort of the simplest case for bivariate generating function, how you inform your eyes how to look at the generating function and recover the asymptotics. So I'll look at f of xy, and so if the coefficients are non-negative, that simplifies things somewhat, which is not the case in our quantum world. They're complex numbers; they're not positive reals. But this is a start. If they're non-negative, in most of the probability world, the things you're interested in are non-negative and sum to one. So let's assume a sub rs greater or equal 0, summation a sub rs equals 1. And so we have f of xy equals, let's say, p of xy over q of xy. And if we draw this, so under these hypotheses, we sort of only have to look at the real drawing. So even though I think of this as a function of two complex variables, I can analyze it by looking in R2 at f, and I get, if I look at where q equals 0, I get some kind of curve. It always cuts off a little corner of the positive orthon like this. And let's consider the smooth case. Won't always be smooth, but generically this is smooth, and quite often in applications it is. So let's look at that because it's easier to say something about. And then let's transfer to log coordinates.
Smooth case, I'm referring to the curve.
I'm referring to this curve here, yeah. Let's transfer to log coordinates. That means I want to graph where q of, so instead of the x and the y axis, I want the log x and the log y axis. I'm really only interested in the positive orthon, right? So this stuff won't exist, but log coordinates, and then I'm going to draw it like this, and I drew it, the important things, it goes through the origin, that's because of this. It's okay if it doesn't, but this is, again, this is the simplest case, involves it does go through the origin, and it's, as you can see, it's convex this direction. And so let's suppose these hypotheses are true, and one other hypothesis I won't state, which is just that the, you know, you have this real singularity, and there's no singularity on the torus other than this real one. So under these hypotheses, it doesn't matter too much what they are. We have the following theorem, actually a theorem, that says that A sub R comma S is asymptotic to, well, let's see. Put that thought on hold while I draw you a little picture of what it's asymptotic to. So I want to compute, so this is the variable space, xy space, or actually log x and log y space, but I'm computing asymptotics, and the index of my asymptotics is some vector r comma s, some pair of positive integers, and so let me draw that. And so to figure out the asymptotics for ARS, I have to find the support point for the normal to this vector. So I just draw this hyperplane, and then I smush it till it hits here somewhere, like this. And let me call this point here x of rs, y of rs, And so A is asymptotic to x of rs to the minus r, y of rs to the minus s. Actually, maybe it's easier if I write this in exponential notation. Asymptotic to e to the minus xy inner product rs times a constant that depends on, this whole picture only depends on rs up to scalar multiple. So I'll write constant depending on r hat, unitized rs, times r, the negative 1/2 power of the length. Okay, so this is some general formula. It looks a little funny at first, but I claim, so this parenthesis goes there. So there's a constant, there's a polynomial term, the minus 1/2 power of your index, or the modulus of your index, and then there's an exponential term, e to the minus this, it's not quite linear, but because x and this point xy depends on the direction r hat here. Keep that dependence in mind. Partly depends on rs. Depends through the direction. Okay, so I claim that already this contains the following things of interest to probabilists. It contains the weak law of large numbers. Okay, in a very limited case. So if I look at the sum of IID, let's say, positive integer or random variables with right moment condition. So it contains the weak law of large numbers, it contains the local central limit theorem, and it contains large deviation estimate. Okay, so let's just see why that's true. So there's some fancy stuff I want to say about this higher dimensional generating function, but I really can't say it without getting a little bit of understanding of this case first. So let's look, so the most important term here is this exponential term. And what is this exponential term? Let's have a closer look. So I have to take this e to the minus x dotted with rs. Let me just look at this particular support hyperplane and its particular normal, which I'll call r star. It's a direction, so r hat star. For that one, it's easy to tell what this dot product is because one of the terms is zero. So that says if I take asymptotics in that direction, I don't get any exponential decay. Okay? So if you're going to be doing probability theory, you might want to apply this to the following generating function. I take g of y to be the summation Pn y to the n equals 0 to infinity, some distribution on the non-negative integers, right? So Pn greater equals 0, summation Pn equals 1, and some moment condition on the p's. And then I take 1 over 1 minus xg of y. So think of f being like that. 1 over 1 minus x times g of y, that just says that I put a 1 here, then along, this is the things with x to the 1 times y to the something will just be the distribution of a random variable with distribution g, and then g squared. So if I look at the r, s term, I get the probability that the sum of r independent random variables is equal to s. So think about that application. Now, so there's one direction here in which I don't get exponential decay. Now, the rest of the directions, let's take a different direction. Here, I have e to the minus x dot r, and here's my hyperplane. And you can see that if my hyperplane were this one, then, see, this x, the point is this x dot r is positive because this is on this side of the origin. So by convexity, in these other directions, I get e to the minus something. So e to the minus x of r inner product r is equal to e to the minus some constant gamma sub r hat times the length of r, where gamma of r hat star equals 0, but gamma of r is greater than 0 for r not equal to r star. I'm putting hats to these are just directions. So in every direction of asymptotics other than this one, I'm getting some kind of exponential decay, okay, which is more than I need for the weak law of large numbers. Okay, weak law of large numbers is proved. And also the large deviation estimate, if I then plug it in, I see I get in every other direction, I get a certain exponential decay, and then I get a constant, and then I get this r to the minus 1/2. So I actually get the local large deviation estimate. That's nice, too. What about in between? If I look at a closer level, why do I get a local central limit theorem? Well, okay, time's short. I don't want to go through the equations, but if you take a look at this exponential here, for some, so this is, in this picture here, we have some kind of quadratic where if I go in this direction, then this dot product is actually literally zero, but if I go a little bit away, so if I move away by an angle of epsilon, then this becomes a linear function with constant epsilon squared. So, and it's multiplied by the length of the vector r. Okay, so how big does the angle have to be before this, what's inside the exponential there, becomes significantly different from zero? It has to be, if the length of this vector is r, the angle has to be such that epsilon squared equals r. So epsilon is like 1 over root r. So r times epsilon squared has to be significant. So I get the 1 over square root. And I actually get, by evaluating this asymptotic, I actually get the local central limit theorem. I get e to the minus the difference to the mean squared divided by the variance. Okay, so in this nice case, the main theorems relevant to probabilists follow from basically just from this picture and this one formula. Okay, this is the nicest possible case. I should mention that even under nice hypotheses, one doesn't always find smooth functions. And let me just give you a quick picture of what happens if you don't find a smooth function. What happens, for example, if your function looks like, it turns out it's smooth most places always, but what happens if it looks like that, and the limiting, there's some kind of little point there, and so we have a limiting normal direction like this from one side and a different limiting normal from the other side. So for directions where the support hyperplane is not at this funny bumpy point, you get the same thing we got before. We get some exponential rate of decay and local CLT behavior, but there's this cone of directions for which we get, well, something like this holds, except the dependence, so this term goes away, and the dependence of this constant on r becomes interesting, and it becomes some kind of generalized Fourier transform, and I don't want to go there yet. I'll say something about that in a higher dimensional case. But let me pay off a little debt, because this is the geometry in the case of a one-dimensional quantum random walk. So the way, if I, let me just make a graph of the squared amplitude of the quantum random walk. So this is psi of n amplitude squared for some, we fix, maybe I should call it psi of k amplitude squared. If I look at the n steps of the quantum random walk, and this is k, and depending on which version, either I go from minus k to k or from 0 to k, depending on your normalization, let's go from minus k to k so that I can remember what the interesting points are. K over root 2 minus k over root 2. Okay, so I get exponential decay outside of some interval. It turns out to be this interval. And then inside this interval, the exponential thing vanishes, and I get something that looks like an upper envelope that looks like some nice algebraic function, actually, got square roots in it. And then it looks like this, so I have a phase term and a limit law for the amplitude term. Okay, so that follows from basic multivariate generating function theory also. Now, at this point, just a small number of minutes away from the end, at this point I need to say the rest of the talk is, so all of this is stuff relatively recent and not published, but the rest of it is work in progress. And I don't know all the answers. It's joint with Yuli Baryshnikov. So what happens in higher dimensions? This particular, so I won't say what happens, for smooth functions you get a very similar theory when the denominator has a smooth zero set. But this one doesn't. This one looks like a cone. I have some pictures. Is this working? Okay. So anyway, if you can get that set up with a, over here is nice. Do it. So aside from deriving that generating function back in the one-dimensional case, I haven't given you any proofs. So here's the part where I give you some sort of argument for why some of this is true. So first of all, what I've just drawn is the zero set of this part of the denominator. And if I look at the next slide, so the denominator actually is a little more complicated than that. And the zero set really looks like that. It's a cone, and then there's a plane crossing through it. So, okay, so so let me give you the one-minute argument for what answer you get, right? So A sub R comma S comma T equals, this is an exact equality via Cauchy's formula, integral over a little torus, x to the minus R, y to the minus S, z to the minus T, f of x, y, z, dx over x, dy over y, dz over z. So I integrate this thing over a little torus near the origin. Okay, that's just Cauchy's formula. Old news. Now, if I move this torus, I expand it, and let me change to log coordinates. Expand it, change to log coordinates. Then this torus, as it nears the unit torus, in log coordinates, it's nearing the imaginary free space. So I get A of RST, again, equals 1 over 2 pi I cubed integral over the imaginary space to the origin of e to the minus x dot r, different f in log coordinates, which I'll write 1 over cone of x, y, z. In log, let's just assume in log coordinates this comes out to be exactly a quadratic. In fact, by linear change of coordinates, exactly 1 over x squared minus y squared minus z squared. And then dx over x, dy over y, dz over z. The exponential change of coordinates just makes that dx, dy, dz. Right? So it's equal to f hat of r, the Fourier transform of this. It's actually equal to that. So now, Fourier transform of 1 over x squared minus y squared minus z squared. Okay. And that's because this thing looks like, well, this part of it anyway. So ignore the 1 minus z squared for a moment. But part of it just looks like a cone, which when you transform to log space and you straighten it out, you take the leading term, it looks like this, up to some easy change of coordinates. Okay, so then, and now in answer to the question raised earlier, what's the same when you change your quantum coin is the geometry of the vanishing set. It looks like, for example, for a different four-way quantum coin, you get a different cone, but it looks geometrically the same, a quadratic cone looking like that once you change coordinates. So the Jacobian introduces some kind of different density. But okay, so what is the Fourier transform? So first of all, so this is a generalized Fourier transform. You can't actually integrate this. This is non-integrable. So it's a generalized Fourier transform, and that's where all the work comes in. So we don't have time. I'm not going to do that. But you know, there's some theory. So if you look in Gelfand's generalized function volumes, then you see how to compute Fourier transforms of algebraic functions that are not integrable, and you have to add a little small real part to this and approach it and do all. But you check that it all works, which we're in the process of doing. We've done most of the geometry, and so then you get the Fourier transform. What is the Fourier transform of a cone? It's supported in the dual cone. So it's sort of zero outside here. That's that exponentially small stuff. And then inside the dual cone, it's approximately, if up to a change of coordinates, 1 over the distance to the boundary square root. So, which is if I take the dual quadratic to whatever this cone was, there's a dual homogeneous quadratic, and then I just take the minus 1/2 power of that, that's the answer. So that's... So you can read this off by inspection, and then the punchline is this is the same term that appears in the Arctic Circle theorem for random domino tilings of the Aztec diamond. It's the same term that appears in the Arctic Circle theorem for so-called cube groves. So cube groves are defined by taking little configurations on finite triangles of points and making the following substitutions, but the one where you substitute three empty points with two line segments, you have a random coin, a three-way coin flip to determine what goes there. So you get an ensemble on these large things that look like, here's a drawing of one of them, like that, and you see non-randomness in the corners, randomness in the middle, again, a circular boundary. And when you look at the generating function for those, it has, again, this same factor, a cone in it. And so there exists limit theory for random domino tilings. And you can find that in papers from the 90s. There isn't, as far as I know in the literature, a limit theory for this. There's a description of the circular boundary, and that's about it. But you get actually the same limit existing there as you do for domino tilings and for quantum random walks. So, because I am out of time, there's something scribbled at the bottom here that I apparently won't tell you. Oh, yeah, it's why this is the Fourier transform of that. But maybe, you know, you can ask me later if you want to know about it, because it's been an hour. Okay, that's it.